On this week's episode of Video Culture, we'll talk about the angsty queen of the 90s, Winona Ryder, in Mermaids and Heathers.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast, in a place where everyone has an opinion, two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills, there will be thrills, and there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acri and Matthew Essery.
And thanks for joining our podcast as my microphone hits me in the face. How are you doing? I'm Ryan Acri.
I'm Matthew Essery.
And how are you doing?
Well, my microphone did not hit me in the face. So I think I'm doing better than you are at the moment. But
well, you've got our new mic stand. I don't have it yet.
What you guys don't realize out there in podcast land is we actually use some pretty fancy equipment here because we like to take our little podcast seriously.
Well, you've got the new fancy. We've upgraded our mic stands. And unfortunately, I just ordered one. And the other one is coming tomorrow. So next podcast.
Yeah. I greedily grabbed it for myself, and I was like, I'm going to use that because it's nice.
Well, you get the good stuff. You deserve it.
Aw, shucks, darling.
All right. Well, let's get past the man love. Let's just talk about one of the fine creatures of the 90s.
When I think 90s movies, when I think 90s films, one of the first people I think of is this person.
Winona Ryder.
Winona Ryder.
Now, we all know Winona Ryder, for her work currently in Stranger Things. And what people may not realize of how much they're watching this movie is of how much that people like us, like, you know, that grew up in the 90s, just like fell in love with Winona.
Yeah.
She wasn't like somebody like a... You know, Heather Locklear, I wouldn't say Heather, but she's not somebody like
She wasn't like this unattainable like thing. She wasn't like a supermodel
like Bo Derek or
Heather. Like say Heather Locklear or Pamela Anderson. She was kind of the beginning of this new kind of movie star who was like an approachable, like, you know, actress. And kind of, I'm trying to think what the female equivalent of the word heartthrob was.
Right.
But she was like this approachable, like almost like dream girl for a lot of guys in the 90s. You know, like they'll saying, you know.
Well, let's just say it for like nerdy, geeky guys.
Exactly. For guys like you and me.
Right.
But yeah, but you know, girls wanted to be her and guys wanted to date her, basically. That kind of old chestnut.
Right.
She was cool. She was cerebral. She was intelligent. She was witty. She was sarcastic.
Right.
And she was just, it was very different for that period of time. And she was in so many great movies. She was in Beetlejuice, Reality Bites, just so many great movies that just personify, you know, the 80s and 90s for guys like you and me.
And so the two movies that we picked this week are two movies that weren't, I mean, we could have picked the obvious choice and gone with like Beetlejuice because that really, I think, like put her on the map as like that kind of character, that sort of, because she was very pale. She was very sort of gothic. She wore black. She was very, you know, that sort of, you know, I'm utterly alone and like that sort of angst queen.
Yeah.
But then, you know, even later on in the movie, you realize that like, how warm-hearted and how sort of fun-loving she was deep down inside. But, I mean, that's an obvious choice.
Yeah.
I mean, super popular movie.
Yeah.
We've seen it 1,000 times. Mm-hmm. Love Beetlejuice.
Same thing with, like, Edward Scissorhands, you know?
Right. Yeah, that same sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so, but we chose Mermaids, which I think Mermaids really is more kind of a classic acting film. I mean, she does play a teenager in the movie, but she plays like a regular teenager from like the early 60s.
Well, and also she's a huge part of the film. She does in both films we're going to talk about today. She does the narration. She's integral to both films, and to me it's almost like it's fun to see her in two very different settings. Right. And Mermaids, like I said, takes place in the 60s. Let's just go into a brief plot synopsis. Right. Basically, Mermaids is about a single mother played by Cher raising her two daughters. The oldest is played by Winona Ryder, and the youngest is played by I believe a debuting Christina Ricci. And they recently moved to New England, where they've set up shop and to try to start their lives over with, because Cher's character likes to move around a lot whenever she goes through any sort of hard times. Like she loses a job or she goes through a breakup, they move to a new town. So they've set up in New England, and they're basically just trying to establish a life for themselves. And that's basically what the movie's generally about. It's very much a slice of life kind of movie where nothing really overly majorly dramatic happens. It's just about these characters living their lives.
Well, drama does happen.
But it's not like, you know, there's like an asteroid falling or like, you know, there's not a guy with scissor hands or, a ghost or, I mean, it's family drama.
Yeah. I mean, there's no real, like we call like MacGuffin sort of drawing you into the story. The only thing that I think that really draws you in the story is like how this family even operates, because they are a very sort of dysfunctional family. In an era of like the early 60s, during like the time of Leave It to Beaver and, you know, Donna Reed.
Yeah, the world was going through change. It was moving from that Donna Reed, Leave It to Beaver quality of the late 50s and mid 50s into like the kind of free love, hippie kind of anti-establishment vibe of the 60s. So we really have a movie about people who were on the cusp of a great change culturally.
Right.
And it explores some of that in the film. But in a lot of ways, it's really just about how this family interacts with each other and how they become – they start the film sort of fractured, and then they become closer as the film goes on.
Right. Well, I mean, Cher – I mean, she plays this kind of, trampy kind of mom, right? I mean, she's a single mom, and, like, when things go rough or whatever – she just doesn't deal with them. She just moves to the next town.
Well, and I'm gonna take a stance and say let's not use the word trampy. She is what we would call in the 21st century. She is sex positive, and that's okay.
Okay.
That is okay.
Agreed. Yeah. But when things get rough, they move on. Mm-hmm. And she more kind of plays like a sort of a friend role, like her and her daughter, Charlotte, played by Winona Ryder, just have this real sort of she's, you know, Winona wants to – or Cher – Charlotte wants to be a nun.
Yes.
You know.
Even though they're Jewish, which is a little running joke to the film.
Yeah. So you have Cher, you have Winona Ryder, you have Christina Ricci in her first film. And you have Bob Hoskins as like the love interest of Cher.
Yeah.
You're talking about four like cult, you know, hero actors.
It's true.
You know, because if you think about Bob Hoskins, he was in The Wall. I mean, he was in...
It's Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
He was in the Long Good Friday.
Yeah.
I mean... Classic films.
Right, and Winona Ryder, who was in Beetlejuice, and then you have Christina Ricci, who was in Addams Family, and a bunch of other movies after that.
And you could tell very early on Christina Ricci was going to be somebody, even from this movie. She's very good in her little part as like the quirky younger sister.
Right. I mean, she doesn't have that many lines, but she plays it fantastically.
Yeah, she's super memorable. She's very adorable.
Yeah.
But to go back to Winona's character, that's what we're talking about today is Winona. Her character in a lot of ways has a very kind of guilty soul. She's 15 going on 16, and she's kind of, you know, she's, you know, starting to feel kind of the urges to be affectionate towards guys. She sort of wants a boyfriend, but she feels guilty about that.
Right.
So the whole movie's kind of, in a lot of ways, is about her conflict between her wanting to be virtuous and wanting to give in to her impulses of youth.
Right.
And you know, her mom's kind of like, oh, well, you should just give in. You'll, you know, have fun, you know, enjoy your life, you know, have a good time. and it causes a little bit of conflict between them. And that's kind of in the forefront. In the background, Cher meets this man in New England, Bob Hoskins' character, who runs a shoe store.
Right.
And they sort of have like a little romance where they kind of fall in love and have sort of an antagonistic relationship.
Right.
And so these two stories kind of interweave between these three characters. And really it's just about how as you grow up, how you kind of become closer with your parents.
True. However, I would say part of it is, you know, Cher's character, her character name is Mrs. Flax or Rachel Flax.
Yes.
Mrs. Flax or Miss Flax, she treats Charlotte and her other daughters like they're her friends.
Mm-hmm.
She's not really a true mom. It's like she avoids being mom. And it's like even when Lou comes in and like does things with him and paints the room. And
Lou's Bob Hoskins.
Yeah, Lou's Bob Hoskins. When he comes in, it's like all of a sudden, he is like tramping on, or I have to use that word again, but he is invading in on, you know, the sort of relationship that she has, this like sort of like, I'm going to take care of you, I'm going to do everything with you. It's almost like they're her own little support group, and nobody else can come into that support group.
Well, and I think part of it, I think you don't, she doesn't want to act like a mom. She doesn't want to have that kind of feeling. And we see that a lot in today's culture where parents want to be the friend of the child.
Right.
And when Bob Hoskins' character Lou comes in, he sort of brings his domestic values into their relationship. So he wants them to have dinner.
Right.
And it's not like he's trying to force you. He's like, naturally, hey, we're going to sit down and have dinner. We're going to do family activities. And it's very sweet and very natural. And it really wigs Cher's character out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she really gets scared of that. But that's a common theme. As I hit my mic again. That's a common theme with young pregnancies.
Yes.
Like she was saying, so in the movie, Charlotte, you know, she, first of all, she thinks she's pregnant just by kissing another boy.
Yes.
So that tells you right away her mom is not really teaching her about, you know, real life and about the birds and the bees and things. But what's also like revealing about it is that later on when they sit down and have a discussion, you know, she says, you know, I was about, your age when I had you.
Yeah. So that means, she would probably be about, if her daughter's 15, that means she'd be about 32 in the stories. That's a very young, you know, mother-daughter relationship.
Right. And that's why they grow up kind of almost as friends and there's no real sort of authoritative, you know, sort of thing.
So, like I said, I think the movie is about how our relationships between parents and children change over time.
Right.
You know, it goes from being kind of this friendly, you know, kind of, sort of almost antagonistic relationship in a way, kind of friendly antagonism, to eventually being a more traditional mother daughter role through growing up and going through some life lessons together.
Well, what I like about it is that it's a story from, like we say, like an era of like the 60s and or like the late 60s or late 50s, early 60s, where, you know, everything is perfect and we have this picture perfect world. But really, it's like, no, things are not as perfect as you think they are. And it's really almost like a counterculture.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, and also in Heather's, we'll talk about, you know, some of the counterculture and stuff like that. But it's almost kind of similar in that that's one of the things I really liked about this movie is it like shows the other side of certain things about our American culture.
Yeah. Like you never think about people in the late 50s, early 60s being promiscuous or being, again, the phrase sex positive. But that's touchstone. You know, they talk about, you know, the idea that even in the early 60s, young women enjoyed sex. And that's something you don't really think about. When you think back on those times, you think everyone was very prim and proper. Everyone was like Donna Reed. But, you know, but you realize people are still people. That had to be going on. And it's refreshing to see that in a film where it's not treated for like gross out humor. It's just matter of fact.
Right.
You know, these people have affection for each other. And when they do, they're going to sleep together, or, you know, that kind of thing. And it's not treated as like a shameful thing. It's kind of sweet and nice.
Yeah. And I mean, and Mrs. Flax, like she was, had a physical relationship with her boss, like wherever that they were from, you know, at first. And then when she, you know, when they moved up to Connecticut, you know, she was just like, couldn't get anywhere with the doctor. And that's why she didn't like the doctor. Not because he gave her like bad work. It's just because all of her tricks, he was like, nope, I'm happily married, man, you know, and moving about my life. So
yeah, she's someone who's kind of taking the idea of, like, physical affection is affection.
Right.
And she does that with Bob Hoskins' character. And, you know, like anyone, because Cher is very attractive in this movie. He's like, yeah, I mean, of course I'll have this, you know, experience with you. But they very quickly grow to like each other as people.
The most amazing thing in the movie, especially about Winona Ryder's character that I liked, was the narration is the narration in her diary. And that's how she kind of narrates her thoughts because she's quiet, like, and a lot of times, like, when she's riding on the bus, like, you don't know what's going on. And then so, or you don't, like, she kind of can tell the story without using so many pictures. Now, it is an adaptation of a book that was written just a few years before. And, but even in her character, you can tell how the, even when she's just reading, how innocent everything was at the beginning.
Yeah.
And how she kind of sounds at the end, and she's a lot more comfortable with, like, who she is.
Yeah, because you grow and you experience things. And
But I'm saying, but as an actress, I mean, can you imagine having to sit there and go in the sound booth and, like, you're going to read these parts, and then it's just like you but still in that moment, you can't just, like, read. She still has to be an actor and go, okay, I have to, you know, do this part where I'm 15 and, like, I just moved to the city and I want to be a nun and everything's prim and proper and I got to do these things. And then she, you know, she's, like, really uptight. And then, like, later on, you know, when she's telling the story and telling kind of the epilogue of how, you know, freeing and just how much more comfortable she was. That's what I was trying to.
Because, you know, she fell in love with there in the small town. She had a boyfriend who was one of the guys from Vision Quest. You know, it's one of those obscure little movies by the great Don Coscarelli.
Right.
But yeah, so she meets the groundskeeper of this local, like, nunnery. I guess it's the race for it is a place where nuns congregate, and it's just this 25-year-old guy, and they sort of have this little romantic tryst. Which is a little weird considering she's 15. That's something that struck me as odd about it.
Yeah. Well, he's really old. I mean, he's like in, you know.
Yeah, he's like 25, 26, and she's supposed to be 15. And I kept thinking, this kind of makes me uncomfortable that you know, this is happening. Because, I don't know, maybe that would be because it was a different time.
I don't know, maybe because he was raised by nuns.
I don't know,
didn't really get out that much. I mean, like he said, like, all he did was, like, drive the bus and, like, go fishing on the weekends.
Yeah. I mean, as a kid, I never realized how the age difference. I just thought, well, Winona Ryder's really cute. I'm very jealous of that actor. And now as a grown man, I'm like, she's so young, you disgusting monster.
Well, that was a weird scene at the end when she just, like, goes up to the bell tower and, like, he's just, like, right there.
Yeah, like, why is he just, this guy's just creepily hanging around this old convent, just, you know, doing nothing. Like,
yeah, because it quickly turned into the two girls kind of, like, walking around outside to, like, oh, they're making out, like, they're
like why is this guy just hanging around here? But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, things, you know, that you wouldn't necessarily think about when you watch it when you're younger. As an adult, you're like, why is he just hanging out? Is he just is he creeping on her? I mean, it's not played as creepy, but the subtext is a little weird,
right?
But still, Winona Ryder makes it seem sweet.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's meant to be a life-changing moment of, like, going from childhood to somewhat adulthood, basically.
Yeah, it's about growing. And, and, you know, Cher's character grows, too. She learns to let down her defenses and allows herself to have a...
because they wind up staying. Because she said, you know, we would have moved. But she tries to make it work. She actually continues to date Lou and, you know...
And they kind of have a normal... They all have a normal relationship by the end of the film.
Right.
In the very beginning, it's a very quirky kind of dysfunctional relationship. But by the end, it's still a little quirky, but you can tell that it's attained more of a sense of normalcy in the fact that they have clearly defined roles of she's the mom, they're the kids, and they all kind of get along.
Right.
You know? But so what did you think of Mermaids, really, Ryan?
I mean, I really liked it. I think that... it kind of reminds me of some of the other movies. Like, it reminded me, even though that, like that movie, even though it's kind of a more kids movie, the movie My Girl with Macaulay Culkin and Dan Aykroyd and,
what's her name?
Green Queen.
Let me thought. I'm gonna look it up now. I see you. This happening.
We're like old guys. We can't remember.
Well, anything. I wasn't expecting you to name check My Girl. So let me. All I ever think about when I think of My Girl is that Macaulay Culkin dies by bee stings in it.
He does die by bee stings, and Dan Aykroyd. I love Dan Aykroyd in that movie, and I don't want to talk about another movie. Jamie Lee Curtis and Anna Chlumsky.
Yeah.
So, and it's one of my favorite Dan Aykroyd like roles, but it's kind of that same sort of effort, that same sort of essence. Like things just kind of roll, and things just kind of happen, and life just kind of happens, and things just kind of like move along without, you know, because really, you know, I guess that you kind of get caught up in this quest. The only real sort of, you know, thread through the whole thing is Winona Ryder's like obsession with this boy, you know, and everything else sort of like happens around that or whatever. And just like the life of, you know, what it would be, to be a teenager in the 1960s.
Yeah. It's like, I was about that. There's not a huge, like you said, MacGuffin that drives the plot. There's not some big, like epic event that happens. It's not a genre film. Right. There's not some thriller aspect or some adventure aspect. It's life. And it's checking in on the lives of people that, you know, in a different time period to kind of learn lessons about ourselves.
Right. And the music was awesome. I mean, that like 60s, like doo-wop. I mean, this is the era that my dad was really, you know, like a rock and roll DJ.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can just tell this is just like good, you know, AM radio, you know, like, you know, Motown kind of doo-wop sort of hits. I mean, it's really great.
The soundtrack is full of stuff that would have been really popular in the first 3 years of the 60s.
Right.
And it's just really fun, like danceable music. And it's like, honestly, one of the best scenes in the entire film is actually what ends the film.
Yeah.
Because again, we do get into spoilers here on the podcast. Again, this movie's been out since the 90s. You had plenty of time to watch it.
Right.
And we told you we were going to watch it, so you have no excuse. but it ends with, you know, again, Christina Ricci, Winona Ryder, and Cher all kind of dancing in the kitchen making dinner.
Right.
And that's how the film ends. And I remember, I hadn't thought about this a long time, but it struck me as odd that's not how the movie ends, because they use that scene to advertise the movie in all the trailers and stuff.
Right, right.
Like, you go back and watch any of the marketing for the film, that's the scene they show, and it's the very last scene of the film.
Right, because you got to get to all the other stuff to get to that part.
Yeah.
And the whole, like, I think where Lou says, you know, you don't sit down to dinner, this is how you eat dinner? Like, how can you do this? Like, how can you be together, like family, cohesive unit without this kind of thing? So, but no, I felt Cher's performance was, there was still Cher behind all of that stuff.
Yeah.
She never really left Cher at the door.
It's not her best performance, but she has chemistry with Winona Ryder.
Yeah.
And with Christina Ricci, which is what you need. Like, you can tell there's real affection between all three of those actresses, and that's really what makes it work.
I mean, she was believable.
Yeah.
And she still, like, her character, you could still see the change in her character, but it was still Cher underneath.
Yeah. I mean, it's not Moonstruck level of changes or anything like that.
Yeah, right, right, right. I think it's a great movie. I think it's very sort of, you know, a great movie, like a family, you know, type of movie. It's,
if your family's okay with you know, with sex being an undercurrent of a film,
right?
Yeah, but I mean, if your family's okay with that is a theme. It's not overly, it's not dirty, it's not dirty in any way, but it's just, that's a theme of the film,
right?
It's kind of how women kind of handle their sexuality in that time period. And, you know, and again, that's refreshing because you don't really think about that very much.
No.
And, you know, I found it to be a very easy watch. I definitely enjoyed it. I don't know how often I'll revisit Mermaids, but I definitely enjoyed watching it.
Right.
My biggest takeaway was, man, Christina Ricci was an amazing little actress when she was young. Like, she is so natural. She's like, what, maybe six in this movie?
Yeah.
And she is so natural and so believable. Yeah.
I know.
And she just slays it. I mean, and Cher and Winona Ryder are fine. They're they're who they are. But right. Yeah, this little Christina Ricci, you can see why she became such a big movie star after this, because she is so wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And because good child actors are so rare.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, she didn't. I don't think Christina, really overplayed it, and I don't think she underplayed it either. That's a lot of times what happens with the child actors, I think, is that they really are kind of like almost overdone. The director kind of like overdoes their stuff, or they're really sort of underplayed.
Yeah.
I mean, and her character is really underplayed, but the parts that she was in, she just like nails like
she
so great.
Feels very natural. Yeah. Now, speaking about overplaying stuff, we got to talk about Bob Hoskins for a minute. I like Bob Hoskins a lot. I think he's a great actor. He definitely overacts quite a bit in the film.
Right.
He's very kind of loud and boisterous. He makes a lot of faces.
Right.
It's a little odd.
Yeah, well, I mean, because the other characters, I think, are so a little more soft-spoken, sort of, you know.
Yeah, he goes broader, for sure. It's like you expect Roger Rabbit to come running out of the background any moment and start talking to him.
It's true. Yeah. All right, so let's move on to Heathers.
Heathers.
Let's talk,
Heathers is a very interesting movie and watching it through 21st century eyes. But let's give a real brief explanation of what Heathers is.
I need some coffee. Hold on.
Heathers is about a clique of girls in high school called the Heathers. There's three of them named Heather, one of them played by Shannon Doherty, but I digress. And then their fourth friend is played by Winona Ryder, and her name is Veronica. Veronica has been basically kind of socially adopted by the lead Heather to into this group, and they kind of rule the school as like kind of like this mean girl clique. Mm-hmm. But when writer's Veronica doesn't really like being this sort of kind of bitchy mean girl. She wants to kind of be nice to people. She wants to be a normal person. So there's
deep down underneath.
Yeah.
You don't really get that at first.
Yeah, but there's definitely conflict between her and the rest of the group. And the conflict comes to a head when she meets a character named JD, played by Christian Slater, who is basically your typical, like, kind of moody high school loner. He's got cool hair, and he wears a trench coat. And he basically convinces her through a series of events, and this is going to sound like quite a turn, to start killing off people who upset her in the school, starting with the Heathers, basically.
Well, it started off as a joke, but then it turned into, because they faked her suicide because they were trying to cover it up. Yeah. And then it became like a thing. It became a Christian Slater thing. Like,
well, you know, we don't want to spend too much time rehashing the plot.
Right.
But
that's the way it kind of starts. I mean, that's the way JD's character has to like turn the switch, you know, on Veronica basically.
Yes.
To basically turn these people and really he gets her on the hook. There you go, hitting your microphone.
We're gonna kill ourselves on this podcast, ladies and gentlemen. We're gonna die by microphone stands.
I'm talking with my hands too, but over here. I mean, but JD's character, it starts off, that's how he gets her sort of on the hook.
Yeah.
It's like, she's hungover, let's make her like a really sick drink to drink.
She'll puke and embarrass herself.
Let's take the two like popular, bro high school guys and, you know, we'll fake, you know.
We'll make it seem like they're homosexuals and embarrass them.
Yeah.
But then he quickly turns it into something where, let's do something that would actually hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
And his idea of hurting them is pretty lethal,
lethal. Yeah,
But when he first talks about it, he doesn't sound like he means to kill them, but obviously that's his intent, is to kill them. And he does it so gradually that Winona Ryder's character doesn't realize quite what he's doing until it's already started to happen.
Right.
And then when they first accidentally kill the first Heather, the lead Heather, the way they get away with it is they basically forge a suicide note and where she claims to be sad and unhappy, and no one realizes how tortured she is. And so that's what becomes their modus operandi for these murders that they keep doing, is that they kill these people and they make it look like a suicide. And as they're doing it, everyone in their high school basically starts, you know, celebrating these people's lives who were really horrible kids because they left these really poignant suicide notes that were forged.
Right.
And it makes kind of suicide almost like a trendy thing in the high school. And that's basically the plot of Heathers. I don't want to give too much of it away, because even though this is a spoiler podcast, I think part of the joy of Heathers is how it kind of twists and turns and how the story plays out. And I think people should watch it. So I'm not going to go too much into how the movie wraps up, but I want to talk to you about what you think of, of certain motivations in the film. I think JD, Christian Slater's character in this film, had done that kind of thing before. I don't think this was the first time he ever killed anyone. Was with that first thing.
If we're going to psychoanalyze, you know, we're going to pretend these are real people. I would think because of his father, right? And I mean, his father's already sadistic father, yeah, too.
His father is a demolitions guy who blows up buildings for a living.
But he's already kind of sadistic, but already, you know, because it's almost like he gets joy in, like, destroying these things. But anyway, but because Christian Slater moves around so much, to me, the way I sort of thought about things is, like, he moved around a lot, and maybe he started seeing the same characters over and over. Maybe he thought he was like, he would go to a different high school, and he would see a different way of how this microcosm of social structure would work. Mm-hmm. That the football guys wouldn't be bullies. There wouldn't be these group of mean girls that ruled the school.
Yeah.
That they would, you know, and it's almost like he went from school to school to school, and it was almost like he was finally, like, sort of fed up with it.
Yeah.
He'd finally got to the point, like, when, you know, they come up to him and he's just like, that's one of the reasons he has such, like, a cool, like, laid back attitude at first, because he's just like, you know, it's almost like he's kind of in a daze, like, oh my gosh, like, again, you know, again with this stupid crap.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Because it's like, it's not my first rodeo, you know, kind of thing. And
sure.
I mean, and you saw how when he first got bullied, what did he do? He pulled out a gun and shot him with blanks.
Yeah.
Scared the crap out of everybody.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to mess with him after that point. Nobody.
Which, again, we got to talk about watching these kinds of movies through, again, modern eyes. The Christian Slater's character pulls out a gun in the school cafeteria.
After being bullied by the football guys, because he's the new guy.
And think about how kind of dark that is when you're looking at, you know, the 21st century in the modern day, when we have school shootings, and he's even wearing a trench coat. You think about, you know, that old phrase of the trench coat mafia kids who shot up, you know, Columbine.
Well, you have to remember, this movie was done in 1980. We failed to mention before, Mermaids was done in, like, 1989, I think.
Mermaids was 1990, I think. Heathers was in 91, wasn't it?
Well, you make me look it up. But no, I mean, 1988, actually.
So Mermaids was after this, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, I got them out of sequence. I feel like I let you down.
That's okay. That's great.
But anyway.
No. You're absolutely right. Yeah. Heathers was 1988. Because Winona Ryder, if you want to know Winona Ryder's, like, since we're talking about her and this episode is all about her, she was in Heathers in 1988. In 89, she was in Great Balls of Fire. 90, she was in Edward Scissorhands. 90, she was in Mermaids.
A lot of dysfunctional relationships in that list.
But 88, she also did Beetlejuice. So she did Beetlejuice earlier that year.
A lot of dysfunctional relationships in that list.
Beetlejuice set earlier in 88, and then she did Heathers later in 88.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a lot of stuff.
But 1988, think about it. Yeah, it's going to be 1988. And when he pulls up this gun, he fires up these blanks, and they don't even suspend him. Yeah, I think he gets detention for it.
Yeah.
It's wild looking at it through modern eyes, you know? He just seems so ready to do these things in the film that I really think, just to extrapolate and just to talk about them for a bit, I wouldn't be surprised if you talk to the screenwriter of this movie that he intended that JD had probably done something like this in one of the other schools he was at before he came to the school of the film.
Well, I mean, we'll have to ask Daniel Waters. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe Daniel can answer that question for us some other time. But, I mean, regardless.
Yeah.
Let's just talk about the movie by itself. Because that's why there's a lot to talk about this movie. I had watched this movie, like, a long time before. Like, I was a, you know, fan of Christian Slater, a fan of, you know, Winona Ryder. And my friend was like, oh, you need to see Heathers. Like, okay. And, you know, I watched it one day, and I remember thinking, like, how dark it was, like, the first time they because the it really takes a big twist, because even if he, like, shoots the person with a blank, you're like, okay, but he's just, maybe he's just, doesn't like bullies. That's his way of dealing with them from the beginning. But then they, like, kill off the main Heather.
Yeah.
And you're like, it takes a big turn, and you're like, what the heck is going on? So you kind of get caught up, like, listening to JD yourself.
Yeah.
You kind of get caught up in this sort of rhetoric.
Yeah. He's likable, and you want to think of him as the protagonist,
right,
as the good guy. And really, he's not. He's really the villain of the movie.
Because what he's doing is he's basically saying, these people don't have a right to be bullies to these people. They don't deserve the right, because, you know, anybody who goes to high school in, like, a modern era, like, outside of, you know, in the 90s, like, they know exactly who these characters are. They know exactly who the football players are. They exactly know who the Heathers are.
Yeah.
They know who the JD character is. They know who Veronica is. They know who the other kids that they picked on, you know, are.
Yeah.
And they either were one of them, or they know somebody, you know, like them. And so everybody identifies with it. And that's why I think that it's so, you know, well written from that perspective, because it's just like, it really does capture, even though that the language is kind of, you know, not really typical, and it's very sort of lofty sort of speak.
Yeah. People talk how you would want to talk, not how people actually do talk.
Right.
Yeah.
It's very sort of idealistic in the way that they're, you know, talking on a high level.
Or it's needlessly vulgar. Like, there's, and not that we're prudes here on video culture, but this is some of the language, especially from the guy high school characters, like the football players, is really crude.
Well, I mean, in every scene is in every conversation is incredibly crucial to the plot.
Yeah.
There's no, like, just like, oh, this is what this is going on and whatever. Yeah. I mean, it's a very serious film, you know, that has to tell that whole story.
But it is wrapped around in some, it is wrapped around some really dark satire.
Oh, it is. I mean, it's called a black comedy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's described as that way.
Well, there's like there's one scene where they kill off the two bully football players. They want to stage it to make it look like they were gay lovers who couldn't live with their secret anymore. And as they're planning to make them look like they were homosexuals, one thing JD does, he's like, I've got all these props, we're gonna plan on them to make them look gay. And one of the things he pulls out is a bottle of mineral water. and when Underwriters Veronica's like, a mineral water, and she's like, he's like, yeah, because we live in Ohio. If you have anything other than a beer, they're gonna think you're funny. And sure enough, when the cops are investigating it, well, the cops like, I know what's going on here. Obviously they're homosexuals. And he goes, why do you say that, Bob? He reaches out and pulls out the bottle of mineral water. He's like, well, look here.
Yeah, he doesn't look at the gay magazine
or like any of the other paraphernalia. It's what convinces them that they're funny, quote unquote, is a bottle of mineral water.
Right.
And that's some biting satire.
Right. It's a setup joke for sure. Yeah. I mean, even the two characters' names, the two cops' names, are the two cops from Adam 12 or whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's all kind of set up. I mean, the three main characters are called Heather. I mean, that's why they call it Heathers. Yeah, I mean, how stupid.
It's kind of to show how vapid and shallow these people are. That they don't even really have their own identities. They kind of share a group identity of just being these mean, bitchy girls, you know?
Right, but even though the main one, like, if there was a Heathers at another school, you'd have like one Heather, but the other one would be like Tracy, and the other one would be like Denise or something like that. But you would all call them the Heathers. Yeah. Well, their all names were Heather, you know?
Yeah, it's just a way of quickly illustrating just how vapid they were, though, you know?
In a modern context, you said you enjoy the movie.
I did.
More now than you did back.
Well, because to me, when I saw it when I was younger, it just came across as really, really mean-spirited. And it does now, too. But I get more of the satire of it. I get more what they were trying to say.
Okay.
It's still incredibly bleak.
Right.
For a dark comedy, it is dark.
I mean, I guess coming from, you know, somebody who was like picked on a lot. I mean, it's like you want to do these kind of things to these people, like, you know, you want to inflict some sort of like, you know, you can't do this to people anymore kind of thing, you know?
And I think that's what's something I think is actually pretty cool about the film is it's a little bit of plays a little bit of wish fulfillment, but then it shows you the horrible reality of what happens when you do something like this.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it shows the funerals. It shows how you know, people were hurt.
Yeah.
And it illustrates again how bad people are by the way they elevate them because of the suicide notes.
Right.
But you deal with the funerals. You see people being upset, and and the deaths are not pretty. When the girl is poisoned or when the guys are shot, it's staged more like a horror film.
Yeah.
And it's not portrayed wish fulfillment kind of way. It's not portrayed in a cool way. It's really portrayed in an ugly way.
Well, one of my favorite scenes in the movie is Veronica and JD are at the boys, like one of the boys' funeral, and like the sister, like they're talking
and they're making fun.
And then like the sisters who's like in the front row, like looks back and has these eyes that looks right through them. Like, are you seriously? Yeah, that's my brother
that's dead up there and you're making fun of him.
Right. But really,
it's a moment of reality.
It is a moment of reality. And it hurts. Yeah, exactly.
And it kind of makes you feel guilty for wanting that wish fulfillment. I think it's kind of meant to hint at the journey of Winona's character, Veronica, because at first, when she goes along with it, she kind of is thrilled by it. She thinks it's kind of fun. She's a little freaked out by what happened. But she kind of deep down liked it and wanted to do it again. But throughout the movie, she realizes this is really crazy. This is really bad. We can't keep hurting people.
Right.
And those ideas are planted throughout the movie that, sure, it wants to feel like wish fulfillment, and you can read it that way. But it's really saying that all this stuff is terrible. Right. That JD's not a good person. That JD's not someone to aspire to be like. He's actually a horrible, maladjusted person. And he's, like I said, he's the villain of the movie. He's really the antagonist.
Right. I thought the parents in the movie were portrayed, they were just like so oblivious to everything. I mean, it was just like unbelievably oblivious and how they were treated and how even Veronica treated her parents, you know?
Well, I think when you're a teenager, that's how you see your parents. I know when I was that age, I got away with things. Maybe my parents knew about it. Maybe they didn't, but they certainly seemed oblivious.
Right.
To what it meant for me to go off and have crazy shenanigans when I was in high school, doing things I shouldn't have been doing with people I shouldn't have been doing them with, and feeling like I was getting away with something because my parents just didn't know. They didn't realize.
But, I mean, it just proves your point, though, that they are sort of caricatures of like real parents, you know, like, and all of these characters are really caricatures, but I still think, like all of the scenes where the kids get picked on, those are all sort of very real
because they want you to kind of understand where JD and Veronica are coming from until it gets too ugly where you're like, they want you to feel guilty about wanting to do it. You know, like so you have that idea of I wish I could stand up to bullies. I wish I could be like the Punisher, like Batman, and just, you know, blow these guys away. And then you realize, well, no, that's a terrible impulse to have.
Right.
And that's not a good thing to feel that way.
Mm.
And the movie kind of makes you feel one way, and then it shifts to the other, saying, okay, you know, it makes you in the beginning think that it's a cool thing to do.
It makes you very angry.
Yeah.
It makes you very angry. And you're like, you side with JD, you know, at first. And I think that's where, you know, when I watched it as a kid, I got sucked in.
Yeah.
You know, but then seeing now, I see that part. I see the harsh realities. I see, you know, because then I thought, oh, well, that's just kind of kitschy cool or whatever. And like, you know, it's kind of like living on the dark side or living on this Bonnie and Clyde kind of, you know, kind of thing. But seeing the harsh realities of it now. A movie like that would never get made today.
Oh, God, no.
And then especially after the, you know, Columbine and all the other school shootings that we've had over the past years that I don't need to mention. It's just unbelievable because it is a violent movie. I mean, it's almost, like you said, it's almost kind of horror.
Yeah. Well, you feel bad, and one thing that made me feel incredibly bad in the movie was it talks about how it kind of, people in the school started thinking suicide is kind of an attractive option, because all these people who they believe have killed themselves, who were actually murdered, they all think these people left notes that kind of cause them to be reevaluated by the school at large and be seen as nicer people.
Yeah, but it romanticizes.
Exactly.
It romanticizes death in like a yeah. strange way, yeah. a very strange way.
And there's one character, she's an overweight girl in the film, and she's feeling very sad. So she decides to kill herself because she's thinking, all these other people had killed themselves and then they were liked more. I'm going to kill myself. And she's completely a victim of all this. And that scene, you know, as a grown man who went through high school, who went through all those hard times of being different, that really kind of wrecked me, thinking about what this poor girl was going through, to think that suicide, you know, is an option to have people care about you. Mm. That's one of the satires, is that these people weren't really loved or thought well of until people believe they killed themselves.
Right.
And that's such a sad, dark thought.
It is. I mean, that's one of the things I sort of like didn't like about the movie, watching it now, of how much it sort of like glossed over and how quickly like dark it got. But it's almost like things got dark, but you only had these small fleeting moments of how yeah. serious it really was.
Yeah.
The ending, I mean, it does sort of have a resolve, right?
Yeah.
Like,
well, in the end, I don't want to go into too many spoilers about how it ends. But
I will say that, I mean, I am going to have to talk about the ending, because there is that the ending that we have, the ending that is in the movie is technically an alternate ending of what the original the original ending.
Well, let's go ahead and talk about the ending then, because basically it comes down to the idea where JD has tricked everyone into signing a petition that is in reality a mass suicide note.
Mm-hmm.
And his plan is to blow up the school and to basically have that be a message to society about how dysfunctional high school life is.
Mm.
By making it look like an entire school committed suicide by blowing themselves up.
Right.
So he goes to plant bombs throughout the school, and Veronica basically stops him in sort of an action hero-y type scene at the end where she, you know, gets a gun and, you know, it's like, tell me how to defuse the bomb, you know, that kind of thing.
But anyway, he winds up you know, thinking the better of it after he kind of gets shot up and winds up like blowing himself up
yeah.
in front of the school.
Yeah.
And you know, because
like a suicide bombing kind of
right,
thing.
Right. Because, you know, he realizes that, you know, the end is inevitable. Like what's going to happen to him, you know, for everything else. And, who knows? That's still a strange thing. And we'll talk about, do you want me to talk about like what the real ending was,
or do you want me to save it for
the end?
Let's do it now. Now's a good time.
Okay.
So what was the original ending, Heathers? I know that I can look this up, but I actually don't know, so I'm curious to hear.
Let me get to my notes. It's in my notes. I was saving it for the end. It was going to be so good. You're ruining it all. No, I'm just kidding.
Aww.
You're just
I'm going to kill myself now.
No,
right?
I mean, it was going to be brought up one way or the other. In the original script, JD blows up the high school.
So he succeeds.
Yes.
Huh.
It blows it up. But, of course, the movie executives, said, you can't do that. You cannot do that. This is ridiculous. And JD wins, and it just kind of ends like a cold ending. Just kind of like, boom.
Yeah, I don't like that either. I mean, I get why that could be an ending for the film, but it also completely devalues the arc that Veronica goes through, because in the end, when Veronica saves the day, she basically really goes back to being a person who's just nice to people, and actually ends with her being nice to the poor overweight girl who tried to kill herself.
Right,
and she goes back. She basically kind of. She grows as a person. She goes from being this kind of mean girl wannabe to back to being a normal person who values people beyond, you know, their social status or their appearance.
Yeah.
And if you have JD just blow up the school, that
none
completely
that
destroys the end of the arc. So it's just, it becomes really just a bitter kind of social statement.
Well, I think it still deals with like the harsh reality of what happens when you let your, you know, rage go too far.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But, yeah. I mean, we already kind of see that throughout the whole film. So why do we need a climactic moment at the end where he does that and gets away with it?
And I love dark endings. I love a good, dark, abrupt ending. But I think that it just makes so much of the rest of the film, one, pointless,
yeah,
and two, redundant.
Well, I agree, because I still think I think you have to have a character that goes through some sort of change, like we always say, right?
Yeah.
And it's the story that kind of keeps you going, because she, you know, realizes the, you know, midway through that, like, okay, now I'm caught up in this. Now how do I get out of this?
Yeah.
And she almost becomes the victim because, yeah, you know, JD comes to kill Veronica.
Because she breaks up with him. Yeah.
She winds up outsmarting him.
Yeah.
You know, and pretends that she, you know, hung herself, you know. But what's funny about that scene is that we watched it before and we knew it.
Yeah.
You know, but if you, and I'm sorry I'm ruining it for everybody that knows,
mm-hmm,
but you don't know when you watch the film. Yeah. You don't really know that she didn't kill herself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, like, she just, like, comes, you know.
Yeah.
And then her mom opens up the door, sees her, freaks out, and she's just like, oh, mom, just can't it, you know, basically.
Yeah, it's weird. Hard. It's hard to remember how you originally reacted to those scenes, but it had to be pretty surprising when you first saw it. It's hard. I can't remember how I first reacted to it when I was younger.
I remember going, oh, my gosh, now she's, you know, like, buying into this whole deal.
Yeah.
You know, like, what is she doing? And then you realize it's why she's doing it.
Yeah, but let's talk about, again, this is about Winona. And she's great in this movie. She is so good.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, she completely sells this completely ridiculous story. And she is radiant. And she's just wonderful in this film.
The funny thing about this movie is she's supposed to be this popular, you know, popular girl, yeah, right? But she's still like Winona underneath. You're still, yeah, like, no, you're like the Beetlejuice girl. You know, yeah, you're like the D. You're, you know.
Well, I think that's just kind of shorthand to show that she's like, they cast her because it's a shorthand of saying, oh no, she's more thoughtful than these other girls.
Right.
You know, it's kind of them saying quickly, she's not like these other people just because of who it is. You know.
I mean, but. She's completely captivating.
Yeah.
She, you know, she draws you in, and you really don't even like her when she is. Even how she plays when she's part of the group, she doesn't really play a whole member of the group.
Yeah.
And I think that's why that Heather sort of picks on her.
Yeah.
You know, a lot, and has her dust stuff, because she's not just like, she doesn't buy into it.
Completely,
and you realize, yeah, that. You realize, like, she's not really,
yeah,
like this evil sort of like mean girl kind of girl, yeah, you know?
And like her casting is to immediately make her seem slightly other from the rest of the group.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to mention something kind of funny to you. Did Christian Slater's voice seem really high in this film to you?
It did, but I'll have an explanation for that, okay, in my notes too.
Really?
You're getting to all my notes.
I'm curious, man, because as I was watching it, I don't remember him having such a high-pitched voice in this. I mean,
yeah, his performance was, it's almost like he played kind of a minstrel type. Like, he was very sort of animated. He was, yeah, very sort of whimsical. You know, he had this, like, really dramatic way of being and talking and stuff,
yeah,
like that.
Even moving. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
He kind of fluttered his coat when he moved. Yeah.
Right.
It's very, very dramatic, very theatrical.
Mm-hmm.
The whole movie is very kind of hyper-realistic. I mean, it's obviously not set in the real world.
Right.
You know?
It's almost like a dream.
Yes. It works a little bit on dream logic. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, kind of how things kind of are just not quite, you know, perfectly lined up, or just kind of,
yeah,
just oddly quirky. You know?
Yeah. And like the logic is just left of center just a little bit, where it sort of makes sense, but it just enough to make it all kind of string together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if that makes any sense.
Right.
So Brass Tacks, what did you think about Heathers?
I mean, I love it. It's one of those movies that I remember as a kid being so great, and I'm still captivated by both Christian Slater and Winona Ryder's performance. It's a hard movie to watch because it is such a black comedy. I remember when I had it on and I was watching it at home, and I thought, you know, my wife, oh, yeah, she'll like Heathers. I mean, she likes that kind of stuff. She likes,
yeah,
you know, Beetlejuice, and she likes you know, The Night Before Christmas, and
Nightmare Before Christmas,
excuse me. And I thought, you know, she would kind of be into it. No, she went into the other room. She's like, oh, you're watching Heather's. Okay, I'll be in the bedroom, like, watching something else.
Wow.
You know, so it's like, okay, all right. Yeah,
But after rewatching it, I totally get it. It's not a pleasant movie.
Mm-mm, no.
Yeah. And while I can say I enjoyed it, I thought it was really good, it's not one I'm going to rewatch anytime soon.
Right. It's kind of like a car wreck kind of thing. Like, it's one of those that you don't want to...
It's not pleasant, and movies don't have to be enjoyable. Yeah, you know, I'm doing fear quotes like you guys can see me. It doesn't have to be enjoyable for it to be good. And to me, Heather's not necessarily an enjoyable experience.
No,
it's a good movie. It's interesting, but it's a hard film to just sit with and think. I don't think I'm going to watch Heather's and have a good time. You know.
Well, like I said, all of those scenes, like you mentioned, how horrific they are. They're really jarring.
Yeah.
You know? You're like, wait, I mean, they just killed off these. They killed them, you know?
Yeah.
This is murder. This isn't right. You know, like,
yeah.
This is crazy. And it's not done in like a, you know, action hero or like kind of way or like where it's sort of justified.
It's blunt and kind of ugly. Yeah.
So, but I mean, I still think it captures a lot of the, like I said, a lot of the era of like what it was to, you know, I mean, like I said, it came out in 88 or whatever. And I mean, I started high school in 1990. Mm-hmm. So this came out when I was like in middle school. And I mean, high school wasn't that different, you know, from, you know.
I graduated high school in 98. Except for the fashion. The fashion, of course, doesn't match. But like the social structures,
yeah,
were still the same at that time period. I don't know if it's the same for kids nowadays. I have no idea. But in the mid to late 90s, that was high school. You know.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same but different kind of thing.
Yeah.
From what I understand. So, but let's just. But yeah, I think it's worth a watch.
Oh, I do too. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying don't watch it. In fact, I definitely recommend the film. It's just not one that I will watch more than once.
Let's just say it's rated R for a reason.
It's rated R for a reason. Okay. But I trampled on your trivia accidentally twice. So let's move on to the trivia because I'm curious.
Part of the trivia is the production and why some of the decisions were made of what they made it. And so as we're talking about it, it's natural to come out. I'm just picking on you.
Yeah, man. I know. No, bullying, man. You're a kid. I don't have a gun.
Whoa. Oh. All right. So let's talk about the interesting stuff about mermaids.
Yeah.
It was based, I mentioned the book before, it was based on the 1986 novel of the same name written by Patty Dunn. So if you really liked the movie and want to read the book that it was based off of, the author has been known to say she's a fan of the movie. So she likes it. So I don't know how much they changed.
That's rare for an author to like the adaptation of their film.
Right. And I don't know how much they changed of it, but you know, if you're interested and like that kind of stuff, you feel free to pick it up. It was shot, the scenery and where they shot it on location is mostly in Essex County in Connecticut and also in Providence, Rhode Island.
So
it definitely has that New England
feel. Yeah, it feels feel like New England,
for sure. Winona Ryder was nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actress in this movie.
Well, she's good in it.
Right. But do you know who won?
I have to say, I do not.
I would say, hey, if you know the answer, just tweet back at us. But it's too easy to look stuff up these days.
Yeah.
Whoopi Goldberg in Ghost.
Well, she is great in Ghost.
But see, that just, I mean, what's funny is that Winona Ryder in Mermaids is cast as a supporting actress. I mean, she's almost the main actress in this
book. Yeah.
It's
probably it may have been a contractual thing with Cher, you know? And movies are strange like that.
Oh, we'll get to that, too.
Okay.
Emily Lloyd from The River Runs Through It was originally cast as Charlotte.
Really?
Yes. Hmm. But Cher did not like her. She complained that Emily did not look like Cher's daughter.
And Winona Ryder definitely could be Cher's daughter in this film.
Right.
They better resemble to each other.
Whatever Cher says, if you don't make Cher happy, you got to make Cher happy. So she was recast.
And I'm sure the movie's better for it.
Lloyd wound up suing Orion Pictures and eventually settled for $435,000. The reason why is because they got, I mean, she was cast, they got on set to shoot.
And Cher was like,
and
no.
And Cher was like, no, I don't like her.
Yeah.
Get rid of her.
If I could turn back time, I wouldn't have cast you.
Oh, gosh. There it is. So here's another part of Cher's persona, I'll say.
Okay.
They went through three directors.
Really?
Due to clashes with Cher.
Wow.
Three.
That's impressive.
Not just one, two, three. So she's like, you know, so when she said, I'm going to get you fired, you're never going to work in this town again. Okay, bring in the next guy. No, I don't like you. You're fired. You're never working in this town again. Bring in the third guy. So it went through Lassie Hallström, Frank Oz.
Oh, she did that to poor Yoda?
Yes.
Oh, poor Yoda.
Frank Oz, well, very short time Frank Oz had.
Yeah.
It was mostly Richard Benjamin. But yeah, Lassie or Hallström, he was very short-lived, and Frank Oz was very short-lived. They tried to wrangle in some control on Cher. Cher said, no, get the heck out of here.
Yeah, I don't care if you were a Muppet. Get out of here.
I'm going to turn back time on you.
Yeah, see it works.
See, it does.
Yeah.
So the song, the Shoop Shoop song,
yeah,
it's in his Kiss from the movie soundtrack, was Cher's first ever solo number one single.
That song was big.
Because it was solo.
Yeah.
Not with Sonny Bono. Yeah. Yeah, it was big. And it only plays at the very end, which I like because all the other, you know, songs were original to the era.
Yeah.
Roger Ebert gave the movie, give it 3 stars. Thought I read it was... I thought it was more than that. Hold on a second. I want to say he gave it 3.5. So I'm looking that up now. So hold on 1 second.
So as you're doing that, I'm gonna vamp. But we're talking about directors for a second. You know who directed Heathers, right? Same guy who directed Hudson Hawk.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
So if you think about the tone of Hudson Hawk compared to the tone of Heathers, kind of similar.
Yeah, it's very that sort of askew.
Yeah.
Sort of like
it's dreamy. Like it's almost cutesy, but it's weirdly violent in places.
Yeah.
It's weird how Heather's tone seems to work and Hudson Hawk's fails utterly.
That's because I think Hudson Hawk was trying too hard to be a comedy and not so much a black comedy.
Yeah. And but yeah, directed by the same guy.
That is so odd.
Yeah.
But... Now I can see it. That's very insightful. Okay. Yeah,
in fact, when the critic came up for Heathers, I was like, oh, no, not the guy who made Hudson Hawk.
Oh.
Yeah.
But here's what Roger Ebert said about Mermaid. It's not exactly good, but it's not boring.
That's a beautiful micro review right there.
Winona Ryder and another of her alienated outsider roles generates real charisma, and what the movie is saying about Cher is as elusive as it is intriguing.
He's the king of film critics. Yeah.
When I read I read the whole review, by the way, of Mermaids, and I was just like, I just read it and go, yeah, that's everything I thought, but like in so much said in so much a better way than would ever think about it.
Yeah, the patron saint of movie critics for sure.
Oh my God. So if you guys you know, go search RogerEbert.com and go find the Mermaids review. It is fantastic piece of writing.
Yeah. He sums it up very, very well.
Yeah. I mean, and so poignant in I know that those guys, they were like, you have this amount of room on this column. And he's like, okay. And then he just figures out a way to fit it all in.
It's hard, man. You know, I am a film journalist, so I write reviews myself, and it's hard, man. It's hard. It's a real skill and a real talent. I mean, it's like 20% skill and like really 80% just pure talent.
I mean, I could almost just read his article and everybody would be just captivated by it. This whole podcast could just be reading, you know, his reviews because they're so good.
He was He was one of a kind. I mean, yeah. There's a reason I legitimately think he's the patron saint of movie critics.
It has a 73% rating on Rotten Tomatoes,
which is higher than I would expect. But
really, okay.
The movie's not bad. It's just it's fine.
It's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fine. I mean, I liked it. I mean, it's. I mean, I know friends of mine that were around my same age or around Charlotte's same age who watched that movie. Mm-hmm. Especially ones that grew up in very sort of, strict, strict households or, you know, really, really enjoyed that movie. I remember a friend of mine in the neighborhood that was like one of her favorite movies.
I can see it being big of a, with girls of a certain age. It's a very, it's a very girl positive movie.
Well, I mean, just think about the movies that were, based around, young girls or young women. There wasn't a lot, especially that time period.
Yeah, you're right.
All right, so Heathers. Yeah, 19... I actually have in my notes 1989. I sit here and look at my notes, and when we do the podcast, I just look at the cast of characters on the thing, and then I go to my notes. But you made a joke about my cast of characters earlier. Mm. Like, you don't need a list, right?
Oh, I do. I forget things all the time. Is anyone can go back to our archives at the website, video-culture.com, and listen to our archives and see that I forget things like cast names all the time.
Yeah. No, I was trying to set up a joke for you, but you just I left it hanging out.
Sorry, brother.
No, earlier I had my notes up. I was like, yeah, I just have my notes of, the characters' names. He's like, well, you don't really need it for Heathers.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, as we were setting up, you mentioned how you had your notes of your list of characters, and I'm like, why do you need to remember their names? They're all named Heather. Yeah. Sorry, you totally softballed that to me right now, and I just know. Completely missed it.
I did. I tossed it up to you. And yeah. That's okay.
Hey man, we're here, warts and all. And,
well, Drew, you will be okay. So before, you talked about how. What a great casting Winona Ryder was as Veronica. You know who turned down the role for Veronica?
Who?
Drew Barrymore.
Which she would have been good, but it wouldn't have had that kind of... You wouldn't have immediately seen that she was apart from the group.
Justine Bateman?
I like Justine Bateman. She would not have been as good.
Jennifer Connelly?
I love Jennifer Connelly, especially because this is around like Labyrinth, Jennifer Connelly, right, yeah. And that's another one that young Matt was very smitten with when I was a kid,
right?
I think Jennifer Connelly could have done it. She has that same kind of outsider vibe that Winona had at that age.
But would have been more poignant to have. Because we know kind of like the angst driven or like the, kind of like counterculture queen that Winona Ryder is. I mean, would it have been different with somebody Jennifer Connelly?
Yes, because
she would have been more of the, like, she is a Heather kind of,
I think that sometimes actors' personas that they've established in their lives and in their film careers really affects how you see them in films. Mm-hmm. And Winona Ryder is a good example of that. She will always be, the angsty queen of the 90s to us. So, so to me, it fits in that role because she is kind of torn up about what she's doing. She doesn't quite belong to this really popular group. She's there, but she's not one of them. And you get all that just from the visual shorthand of having Winona Ryder in your movie, because of who she is and what she's done.
All of them turned it down for like the dark subject matter, basically. Shannon Doherty wanted to be the Veronica role. Okay, so there's a real quick side story. It's not even in my notes, but I remember reading it. But I'm like thinking, it should be in here. Here's a weird thing about Shannon Doherty. She didn't want to say a lot of the lines in the movie, especially like the opening scene, because there's a lot of foul language in there.
There is.
She was really kind of, she grew up in Memphis in like a nice, Christian home, I believe. And so she was like, no, I don't want to do any of that kind of stuff. And she just thought it was kind of a movie about high school and like popular kids and like suicide and all this kind of stuff. I don't think she really understood the dark subject matter that it was about.
Yeah, I've learned a lot of times actors don't quite get what they're doing when they sign up to do movies sometimes.
And so when she saw the movie, when she went to the screening and saw it, she like ran out like crying because she was just like, what in the world is like, she didn't know how it was going to be portrayed in that way. Mm. I mean, and I guess it goes back to like, you know, having to be seeing our director's vision versus like actually, you know, seeing the final print, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's solely weird. But I mean, when so Shannon Doherty, like I said, wanted to do Veronica, but then they were like, no, you need to be cast. You know, we want you as a Heather. And they actually wanted her to dye her hair blonde, but she obviously didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
So, Brad Pitt was nearly cast for the role of JD.
He would have been really good in it.
But they said that he came across as too nice.
He does have a real likable quality about him.
How is he going to... Yeah, I don't see him being sort of vindictive and like wanting revenge on people.
It goes back to visual shorthand. Christian Slater looks a little sinister.
Yeah.
You know, he's got that kind of that young Jack Nicholson quality about him.
It's odd that you mention that because he based his like performance on based around Jack Nicholson.
I think he's based his entire career around Jack Nicholson a lot of ways. I mean, and don't get me wrong, I actually love Christian Slater too. Christian Slater's been in a lot of movies that I'm a huge fan of,
man.
But he basically his whole vocal style and his way of delivering dialogue is pure Jack Nicholson.
But I think this one, I think this was on purpose.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, what are you talking about, man? Anyway. Yeah. I think it was totally, I think he was trying to capture that sort of charisma.
Yeah.
For this movie. So, because Jack has that, you know, special ability to play characters like this, basically. Yeah.
He can play terrible human beings that you can't help but like.
Right. Exactly. But going back to Winona Ryder begged and pleaded for Winona not to take this role. I mean, she got on her hands and knees.
Wait, no.
Just like begged and pleaded, like, do not, this will ruin your career. Do not take this role.
Wait, no. Who begged her not to take it?
Winona Ryder's agent.
Oh, okay. Winona Ryder's agent. Okay.
Yeah. Her agent said, this will ruin your career. Do not do this. Please do not do this. This will just ruin you. Don't do it. Just begged and begged and begged. And Winona said, no, I love this movie. I want to do it. And it's actually one of Winona Ryder's favorite movies that she's on.
I think it's one of her most well-regarded films for sure.
Winona Ryder did say, that at the time she didn't look very different from her character in Beetlejuice. She was very pale. She said, I had blue, black dyed hair. So she went to Macy's at the Beverly Center and told them to do a makeover on her.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how her hairstyle and all that kind of came from. So she went to where like the girls from that, you know, era who lived, you know, would have gone to get their, you know, to get done up or whatever.
Yeah. This is her way of getting into character.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. The screenwriter, Daniel Waters, he wanted Stanley Kubrick to direct this movie.
Wow.
I mean, this is how dark that he really wrote this movie.
That also shows how much he thinks of his own writing. He's like, the only one who can bring my vision to screen is Kubrick.
I mean, I really seriously think that it really kind of was a comedy, or not a comedy, it really was kind of a horror with some comedic elements, as opposed to like a black comedy.
Well, don't get me wrong, Kubrick would have killed it. Kubrick would have killed anything he did if he chose to. But yeah, I mean, that's like saying I want the greatest filmmaker of all time to make my script. Of course you want the greatest filmmaker of all time to make your script.
But I mean that sort of Kubrick sort of like Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that sort of thing. And I think that's where like Christian Slater also kind of captures his role from, you know.
There's definitely a little bit of Alex from Clockwork Orange and Christian Slater.
Yeah.
Kind of that gleeful, violent quality.
Well, not only that, and Jack Nicholson from...
The Shining?
The Shining, yes.
Yeah.
The opening cafeteria scene is basically an homage to Stanley Kubrick in the same way, like it was almost shot, not shot for shot, but it's very reminiscent of like how shocking, like they talk and how just kind of like mean spirited everything is to like Full Metal Jacket.
I can see it. Yeah.
It's like a Full Metal Jacket for high school.
That's a good way of saying it, yeah.
In the original strip, like I said, JD blows up the high school, but we already talked about that. Also, the book, they were all under... Okay, the book that they were talking about in the movie. So in the movie, they were like underlining... what was it?
It was Eskimo. The book, what was it? Moby Dick?
Yeah, Moby Dick.
Yeah.
So... The book they were really supposed to be talking about, like the original screenplay, they were talking about The Catcher in the Rye. So J.D. is an homage to J.D. Salinger.
Okay.
Veronica is a throwback to like Archie.
Well, yeah. Archie and Veronica. Her other friend that she abandoned, her nice friend who she doesn't hang out with anymore, his name is Betty.
Yeah, Betty, right? Yeah, yeah. Betty, mm-hmm. Veronica, yeah.
Yeah.
Which Betty also was played by... Estevez.
Oh yeah, was she? Is she related to the Estevez family?
Yes, yes, yes.
Oh really?
Yeah.
I saw that last name and I wondered for a split second. I was like, nah.
Yeah, she really is. Cool. Let me go and let me look up on my magic machine here, and I shall tell you. When we look up, go back to here, look at the cast. So the cast, Renee Estevez.
Hmm.
Renee Estevez is the fourth child and only daughter of artist Janae Templeton and actor Martin Sheen.
Well, she's Charlie and Emilio's sister, huh?
Yeah.
I guess she didn't do a lot of other acting because I've never really seen her in anything else.
She did movies. Yeah, there's a lot of... I don't see a lot of... she was in Addams Family Reunion. Yeah.
Not, so then not just a, know. Not a big, yeah.
She was in Deadfall.
Okay.
And yeah, she
didn't Deadfall, do it. Which was one of Nicolas Cage's early films. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can look up her filmography on Wikipedia or IMDb. But anyway, I just thought I'd mention that too. What else? The song "Teenage Suicide," "Don't Do It," performed by the fictitious band Big Fun in the movie. It's really a spoof of the song "Don't Try Suicide," a real song by Queen that came out in
1990. Oh yeah, I know "Don't Try Suicide." Yeah,
yeah, love Queen. It only took 33 days to shoot in July and August of 1988 on a budget of only $3 million.
That's pretty impressive because you know there's lots of locations. You know,
yeah, they shot it on a few different schools in California. The box office that only pulled $1.1 million.
Really? Because, again, it's a movie that you think was successful because it's so well-regarded nowadays.
Well, that's because it became a cult classic because of the video rental store. Da-da-da. Yeah.
And so, yeah. It makes sense. That's why we're talking about it here.
That's why it became a cult classic, my friend. Here's the surprising, well, not really surprising. I'll get to real surprising. Roger Ebert gave it 2.5 stars.
He was kind of lukewarm on it.
Yeah, but I still think, and I'll read you his quote, but before I do, I'll just preface it with, I don't think he really got it, because I don't think that he really went to high school in the era that you and I went to high school. He went to a high school in an era where, you know, people like, you know, guys were like, you know, getting showers, you know, getting naked in the locker room by the showers by themselves. You know what I mean? I don't mean to sound it like that way. I'm just saying that like...
He went to school in a different era.
He went to school in a different era. Yeah. He just went to... I just think that... So I don't think he really understood the microcosm of the like the subculture of the institution and the social structures of, you know, the 1980s, 1990s high school.
Sure.
So, and he says, quote, "For a long time, we're not even sure of the point of view. Is this a black comedy for about murder or just a cynical morality play? The traveler in the foreign country is not sure, but he knows the film inspires thought and has the ability to shock, Two qualities that make it worth considering. Maybe it's true to teenagers will understand it best. Maybe it's even true that they deserve to.
Again, very, very concise and to the point. And he's not wrong.
No.
He's not wrong at all. He's saying that it's of the moment. And he's even admitting that he doesn't necessarily understand it. But he kind of gets that kids who are of that age or who were of that age during that time period will understand what the film is going for.
And he's not pretending to say, no, this is not what kids will like, or yes, this is what kids like of this era. He's saying, he's leaving it up to the teenagers of that. Maybe it will resonate with them, or maybe it will not.
Yeah. Again, he's a really good writer.
94% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
94. Heather's has a 94% rating. I was surprised, too.
I mean, it's a quality film. It's just, it's not an easy film.
No. I mean, I know that sometimes we watch movies and I don't mean to go back into history, but some of the movies that we have a low, Rotten Tomato score. Like for instance, I know we did UHF, for example, yeah. Had a low critic score, but it has a high audience score, right? Sure. This one, the opposite. And it's interesting to me. How we look at that. And I know it's kind of like how different critics look at movies versus how that the audience looks at movies. Because if we look at Heather's, it does have a 94% rating, but the, and I'm pulling it up, I'm buying time here, the audience score is only 84%.
Hmm. Yeah, that's not a huge disconnect, but that definitely shows a disconnect. Because I think audiences a lot of times, and I see this a lot as I review films, because you can recognize a movie is well made and not necessarily, like I said, enjoyable. And your average person sometimes has trouble reconciling the idea of good not meaning always enjoyable. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like a movie can have unpleasant characters and be quality. And some people say, well, I hated it because no one was nice in it, or there weren't any nice characters, or it was mean, or it had a sad ending. And they'll be like, I didn't like it. It doesn't matter how good the movie is. It doesn't matter how well made it is. If it's too dark or too sad or too cynical, people will just say, oh, I don't like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't have to be as nuanced as critics do, because we have to write about it. We have to try to express our points in a way that is nuanced. We can't just be like, oh, it sucks or it's good, you know?
Right. Yeah. You can't just give it just like thumbs up, thumbs down. Or, I didn't like it. Like, it didn't resonate with me. Yeah, I mean, you're writing for, like, a broader audience. Like, well, like we mentioned about Ebert, like, it's not just, like, him. And you can't just, like, look at it from just your own viewpoint. Yeah.
You have to be able to examine your own bias and actually explain the film in a way that seems accurate and fair, but also say what you think about it, but properly explain it, too.
Right.
And why you feel that way. You can't just be like, oh, I hate it. And audiences are often like, oh, I just don't like it. Thumbs down.
Right.
Where a critic's like, well, I may not have enjoyed this aspect of it, but there are other quality things about it, you know? Mm-hmm. It's more of a spectrum.
Right. The only other two notes that I have is that Heather's does kind of live on. And people have talked about, and people still ask Winona Ryder, is there going to be a Heather's 2? I don't know how you can have a Heather's 2 with JD being dead. And her character is sort of like turning over a new leaf.
Yeah.
But in 2010, there was a stage musical. It was off-Broadway. I don't know how off-Broadway, but there was.
Sure.
And I think part of that is because it does resonate with this idea of, like, we want to equal everything out, like this microcosm, like we talk about of the high school or the social structures or whatever, sure. and the bullying and all that goes on. And what do we do with all of that? Sort of rage and how to, cause it doesn't really talk about how do we deal with it in like a healthy way. It talks about how to deal with it in a really unhealthy way. Yeah. So, but in 2017, TV Land launched the Heather's TV show.
Mm-hmm. I actually remember when this was coming out, it was actually delayed for about 6 months because there was a school shooting,
right?
Like a month before it was supposed to come out. So they actually delayed it several months because of that.
Yeah, because the Parkland.
It's Parkland, yes. Yeah. Because I mean, because it goes to show you the concept doesn't really fly in you know 2017, 2018, 2019. We live in a different world now where this is not satirical. This kind of stuff sadly happens, you know. But and that's it. Really makes that's the one reason why Heathers is a little bit hard to watch nowadays. So
I almost had to sneeze. I don't want to take anything away from your point because I completely agree. And that's another reason why I think that it's harder to watch. It was a lot easier to watch when I would watch films back then of like Pulp Fiction or Desperado, where you know you know, Dust Till Dawn, where there's just like a, you know, you kind of get desensitized to that sort of like violence.
Yeah.
But you watch, you know, this when in it, like in the scenes of like kind of its reality. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how you do it in a TV show either. I think that, and I don't want to, you know, say, oh, I got a great idea, but the original concept of like, hey, let's just play jokes on them, you know, really bad. Like, let's just play like huge, really awful practical jokes. Yeah. That's almost like, you know, more along the lines of, you know.
Yeah. Even that feels a little weird.
Yeah, but even so, but yeah.
But yeah, it's, but like I said, the way we perceive violence in film definitely changes as we age and as the world changes around us. And this is one movie that's definitely, unfortunately, been the victim of the world changing for the worse. And in a way, it's a shame because Heathers is a good movie, but it's a movie because but the world around us has made Heathers a much more bitter pill to swallow.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's not, it doesn't feel like satire anymore. And that's unfortunate because it's a good movie.
Right. Well, I mean, it's supposed to be, like I said, like we talked about, like a black comedy, like, oh, let's just watch this movie for like entertainment, you know, purposes, and then we can just go on about it. Or, yeah, that means kind of like candy where it kind of makes us feel good for the moment and we don't have to kind of deal with it.
Yeah.
But, yes, unfortunately, you know, things can go too far and harsh realities happen. And so it's tough to look at that kind of stuff. Yeah. So, but, I mean, I enjoyed watching it. I mean, like I said, I still get a kick out of watching, even though that he's pulling a whole Jack Nicholson on us. I love
I
know, his
again, I like Christian Slater a great deal.
Yeah.
He is actually one of my he was my favorite actors when I was younger, and I still enjoy him when I see him in movies now.
Right.
He always seems like he's having a good time. He always puts in a ton of effort. I'm very pro Christian Slater.
I mean, how would you like to be have that amount of cool? Well,
that would have meant at age like 17, I would have got to make out with Winona Ryder at age 20, and I'd be all about that. I know that's not the most woke thing to say in 2019, but
I mean he had some coolness back to
him. He's super cool in it. Cool. I mean, yeah, I mean just because of me, but that's always you always kind of want to be the every guy kind of one or another wants to be the smartest guy in the room, and that's kind of the persona that Christian Slater kind of built his persona on. Was being the guy who was smarter than everyone else. Quippy and sharp.
All right. Well, what other recommendations do we have then?
Okay, well, I've got one recommendation. It is, of course, a Winona Ryder film. It came out last year in, you know, 2018. It's called Destination Wedding.
Mm-hmm.
It stars Winona Ryder and another guy who we love here at Video Culture, the great Keanu Reeves.
Ah.
They play two basically misanthropes who get invited to a wedding out in Catalina wine country, and they go to this wedding. It's Keanu Reeves' brother, and turns out his brother is also the ex-boyfriend of Winona Ryder's character. So basically, Keanu Reeves and Winona Ryder get invited to this wedding that they don't want to go to. They meet each other in the airport getting ready to board the plane, and the movie never leaves them for the next hour and a half. Literally, Winona Ryder is in every scene of this movie, and it's just them bantering back and forth as like miserable misanthropes, kind of banter back and forth, and then inadvertently falling in love. And it's wonderful. It's full of really snappy dialogue. It's funny. Mm-hmm. It's got wonderful writing. And it shows that Winona Ryder still is the angsty queen of film in my heart, because she's still very much that person, just our age now, you know, in her 40s, but still luminous, still wonderful, still witty and verbose and edgy. And on top of that, it's got the great Keanu Reeves. It's such a fun little movie that it came directed to video last year, but I highly recommend it to anyone. It's called Destination Wedding. If you're a Keanu fan, most definitely if you're a Winona Ryder fan, you got to check it out.
Well, she jokes about, and she's mentioned before of how she thinks, well, she's not really thinks, but she's almost convinced that she is actually married to Keanu Reeves. Have you heard this?
I have, actually. Yeah, they
so, in 1992, she was in Bram Stoker's Dracula, and yeah. So was Keanu Reeves, and directed by Francis Ford Coppola. Mm-hmm. And they filmed, you know, there's a scene where they're in Italy, and Francis being, Francis Ford Coppola being, let's be completely real and about this entire and authentic on the scene. He got his local
priest
to come down and officiate this wedding that was going to be on film. They did the whole ceremony by a priest.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
well, in my fanboy heart, it makes me kind of sad that Keanu Reeves and Winona Ryder aren't a couple, because wouldn't they be like the perfect personification of like 90s cinema culture?
Oh, man, it would be great. Well, I mean, Winona Ryder did actually date Christian Slater after Heathers.
Oh, did she?
Yeah, I mean, Christian Slater was actually dating another girl, one of the other Heathers that was actually in the movie, the one that doesn't have a whole lot of lines.
Christian Udog.
Yeah. So he was dating her, and that's how she got in the movie, is they were dating. But at the end of the movie, Christian and Winona were kind of a thing.
Yeah, because Winona Ryder is magnetic.
Now, didn't Winona get, she was also involved with River Phoenix, I think, at one point?
I believe she was, yeah.
I mean, that's another, amazing, kind of counterculture couple.
It's true, yeah. And again, in a lot of ways, to me, Winona Ryder is the female presence of like 90s cinema to me.
Yeah. So, and I know we didn't talk a whole lot about Winona's performance because we just think it's just so perfect.
Yeah, I know, truly, she is. I mean, she's just great. I've never seen her be bad in anything, really.
Yeah. All right, well, I think that about sums it up. I think we've said more than we probably need.
Well, I just want to say one thing. Winona, if you're out there, if you somehow hear this, you know, look us up on the internet. You know, we'd love to hear from you, you know.
Hit us up on Twitter.
Yeah. It's Video Culture, too, you know. Come by our official website, leave us a comment, you know, find us, we'd love to talk to you, and that's going to be my desperate plea for this podcast.
All right. And I've got my—I almost forgot. I got my recommendation.
Of course. What's your recommendation?
My recommendation is a Christian Slater movie. Actually, it doesn't have Winona Ryder, but I mean, the girl that was in it could have been Winona. Could have been played by Winona, and that is. And now, why can't I remember? Remember this movie? Pump Up the Volume.
Pump Up the Volume. An excellent little film.
And I think Pump Up the Volume to me signifies. I mean, it's Christian Slater. He's almost playing the same sort of character, not quite as angsty, not quite as. He's another character who's moved around from town to town to town and having trouble connecting with other people in his high school, but he connects with them in a much more, I don't want to really say
positive way,
but I mean, he starts his own sort of pirate radio station, and it really is homage to the counterculture, sort of thing, and one that's a lot more positive and a lot more, a movie that I really like that's a lot more fun to watch.
Yes.
And
definitely less murderous.
No, there is no, because the only really thing illegal going on is his illegal FCC broadcast. Yeah. He's getting chased, but I mean, the ending scene, he's mobile in a Jeep and being chased by the FCC.
Yeah.
So that's the only real thing that's going on. It's because he's causing a stir. He's saying things and getting people, getting the, the people of the high school like kind of riled up or whatnot. Yeah.
And we hope that we've got you riled up about seeing any of these movies we recommend today, or you know, see Heather, see Mermaids, see Pump Up the Volume.
All right, but that'll about do it. Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at Video Culture 2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, coming out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us, and let's all watch movies together. I'm Matthew Essery.
And I'm Ryan Acree.
Thanks for coming by, and watch some movies, guys.
Bother you that everybody in this school thinks that you're a piranha? Like, I give a shit. They all want me as a friend or a fuck. You blow it tonight, girl, and it's keggers with kids all next year. I'll tell everyone about tonight.
If Chandler's one bitch that deserves to die.
Killing her won't solve anything.
I'm a no-rest build-up man myself.
Be a dick.
Like a suicide thing, you know? Hey, you can do Heather's handwriting as well as your own, right?
I must say I was impressed to see that she made proper use of the word myriad in her suicide note.
What was the first day after Heather's suicide like?
Just so unfair. Sorry to hear about your friend. Thought she was your usual airhead bitch.
I prayed for the death of Heather Chandler many times. And I felt bad every time I did it, but I kept doing it anyway. Now I know you understood everything. Praise Jesus. Hallelujah.
I've cut off Heather Chandler's head, and Heather Duke's head has sprouted back in its place.
Suicide is a private thing.
Are we going to prom or to hell?